We've been debating the question, should magic mushrooms be legal?
Trippy Hippie asks, what if LSD connects your brain to other dimensions and planes around you? Yeah, what if? Maybe it does. Maybe it did with your brain.
2/3 of the people that were treated with a course of MDMA no longer have PTSD.
Would you call this a breakthrough?
I would absolutely call this a breakthrough.
Hi, I'm Matthias, and this is V1&O, the show where celebrity meets cerebral. On this podcast, which is powered by Yuke's, we ask celebrities, what do you want to know more about? Then, we pair them with a specialist on that topic and let our guests pick their brains all about it. On today's episode, 24K Golden learns about psychedelics. In November of last year, the New York Times came out with an article headlined, "The Psychedelic Revolution is Coming. Psychiatry May Never Be the Same." Silicon Valley and Wall Street are pouring millions into psychedelic research, attempting to study how drug-assisted psychotherapy could be helpful for trauma. Okay, so what does this all mean? The word psychedelic is a mix of psyche, meaning the human soul, spirit, or mind, and delos, the Greek word for manifest. You already know this, but basically these drugs make you manifest shit in your head. Consuming popular psychedelics such as magic mushrooms or LSD effectively causes hallucinations. Colors, sounds, objects, and even time are perceived differently. Some people take LSD and spend 5 hours deciding if Carrie Bradshaw from Sex and the City has good hair or not. But enough about me. With the legalization of other drugs like weed, not to mention the increasingly popular trend of microdosing, a few questions arise. What is the future of psychedelics? How has our government used psychedelics already, such as during the Cold War when they secretly tested them on the American public as a truth serum? And why does nature create these drugs in the first place? That's what 24K Golden would like to know. 24K Golden is a 21-year-old American rapper from San Francisco. After briefly attending the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business, 24K Golden dropped out to pursue a career in music. Dumb idea, right? Not so much. 24K Golden's singles like Valentino and Mood went to the top of the charts, the latter of which has 355 million views on YouTube at the time of this recording. Next, the young rapper will be going on tour with Wiz Khalifa and Logic. But first, he's here to learn about drugs. Hey.
Hey, what's going on?
I was just looking again at Mood on Spotify. It's at like 1.4 billion or something. It's just like, that's a number I can't even comprehend. That's crazy.
Yeah, I try not to think about it too much. I have an existential crisis.
Why is that, do you think? It just freaks you out.
Because it's like you said, like, one, I don't even know what like a million people all in the same place would look like. So to have 1,000 millions, that's crazy to me.
I mean, a lot of artists will say, like, again, they see those numbers and it doesn't feel real until maybe they go on tour. Basically, they see like a live audience so they can be like, oh, that's kind of what's happening. But I feel like also so much of your come up has really happened. You were doing stuff before the pandemic, but you also had pretty big years during the pandemic. So I guess my question is like, have you been able to perform and like meet these people and see these fans who are the ones streaming it into the billions, or have you not done that to the extent you wanted to yet?
Yeah, it's extra surreal for me because like you said, a big part of my come up did happen in the pandemic. Like I was 19 when it started and I'm 21 full adult now, which is trippy. And when Mood was going up, it was just numbers on the screen. I checked back and be like, oh, we did 4 million plays today. All right, cool. I'm going to go back in the house and play 2K in my underwear for 8 more hours. So it wasn't really like, it didn't feel like I had the amount of success I had. And then when things started opening back up and I'm doing these music festivals all over America and stuff like that, and I'm performing Mood or other songs, and I got tens of thousands or 100,000 people singing my song back to me, I was tripping the fuck out. I was like, so there you guys were this whole time. Like, that's crazy.
Yeah, I can't imagine it. Everything that's gone on for you for the past couple of years, as if it's not weird or like a crazy experience in itself, to then pair it with the pandemic, it's just like, it's surreal, like you said. So just through speaking with your publicist, I know by the time this comes out, you're going to have released a song with Travis Barker. So can you tell us a little bit about that song and working with him?
Travis is a cool ass dude. Like, we've worked a couple of times before, but this is our first song actually coming out. And all the success he's had and all the like legacy and prestige he has as like a rock legend, you might think like, oh, this guy's going to be a dick, or he's going to be like just on some like real. Yeah, you might think he's going to be a dick, but he's actually really the opposite. Like, he's one of the most like sweet and like kind and like patient producers or people that I've met, period. So he pulled up to the video shoot. He just shows love, because I think he understands that if you show love, you're going to get it back tenfold.
Just between us and all the listeners, are there camera crews following him around or not so much?
I mean, nah, he's low key, bro. Like, he was just pulling up to the shoot, like, just, you know, him and his peoples. And then, yeah, he's very low key, loading up the drum set, doing his thing. He's like, all right, yo, I got to go get dinner with my girl or whatever. Like, peace.
Yeah,
it's very casual. And I think that's why, like, his humility is why he's been able to, like, besides him being like one of the best drum players in the world, but his humility is like very inspiring.
So then I wanted to ask, like, that's obviously a highlight working with him. I assume you were a fan of Blink 182 and of him and everything before that. What other, again, in the last 2 years, like, is there a particular moment that really stands out to you as like a career high, personal high, anything that's really something special?
It was two of them. It was one that was like career and one that was like personal. Like, career was, we got this festival in San Francisco called Outside Lands. And it's like the biggest music festival in the Bay Area. And I always, like, as a kid, that's a festival that I used to sneak into and shit like that. Like, I dressed up like a construction worker and convinced them that I had like a work order to do on one of the stages. And got them to give me a ride in when I was 16.
Holy shit, that's so creative.
So to go from that to being paid to perform in my hometown and bringing out local artists, Paperboy, who got me into the game, Stunnaman, who's from my city, and like giving them the platform, and like having my mom and my dad and my sister and my cousin all watch me perform, that was like the, oh shit, I made it type of moment.
Yeah. And it is, like you said, it is both a career and a personal. It's like where the two things intersect, right? Because it's your hometown.
Yeah, exactly.
So I want to jump into, before, look, we bring the doctor on, the subject at hand, which is psychedelics. And I guess the very first thing is if you can just tell us, like, why is that something that you wanted to learn more about?
I'm going to tell you why I want to learn more about psychedelics. I think psychedelics are the most revolutionary substance to ever hit this face of the planet Earth. Like, if Steve Jobs did not take that tab of LSD, we might not have iPhones to this day.
I mean, I didn't even know that story. But if that's what happened, then I'm thankful for it. Is that the true story?
Yeah, I think like him and like a lot of other like Silicon Valley crazy innovators were microdosing or like tripping or whatever you want to call it.
Got it. And I mean, like, what's your own personal experience with it? Like, are you around psychedelics a lot? Do you like psychedelics? Do you like not really get into them?
I mean, I've tried them a couple of times here and there. Like, I even did shrooms with my mom before, and that was like the most beautiful bonding moment we had.
Holy shit, what happened when you were tripping with your mom?
Bro, we just laid on the beach and like watched the sunset and like talked about life for probably like 2 hours. Yeah.
Hi, it's nice to meet you. My name is Matthias. This is 24K Golden.
Big Al.
Yeah, awesome. Great to meet you all.
For starters, can you just give us a bit of background on who you are and like why you're an expert in psychedelics?
Yeah, my name is Albert Garcia Romeo. I'm a psychologist. I've been working at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences for the last 10 years, since I got my PhD in 2012. I was actually studying psychology of spiritual and religious experiences, because I was interested in how those could impact mental health, but that overlaps pretty strongly with what the work that we're doing here. So I've been doing pharmacology research ever since, which is specifically how can we use drugs like psilocybin or other psychedelics to create really powerful experiences in a therapeutic framework that can have a positive impact on people's mental health.
Okay, cool. Amazing. Thank you.
Is it all right if I call you Golden?
Yeah, that's my name. You can call me Golden.
Perfect.
Big guy, what's going on, baby? How you feeling?
Good, man. How are you doing?
I'm feeling fantastic this morning. You ready to talk about drugs?
Absolutely.
All right, so let's get specific. What are psychedelic drugs?
Great question, because the word was invented in 1957 by Dr. Humphrey Osmond, and he was specifically talking about specific drugs like mescaline, which is found in peyote cactus, and LSD, which was a really popular psychedelic drug back in the 1960s. But there's also lots of other drugs that people call psychedelic, like Molly or MDMA, sometimes ketamine, even cannabis. Sometimes people can talk about that as being psychedelic. So lots of drugs often get lumped in with that. But we talk about classic psychedelics when we're talking about psilocybin, LSD, and so forth.
And what do these classic psychedelics do to the human brain?
We've been learning a lot more about that since the last 10 years. We've been able to really dig in and study that more deeply. But we're still learning a lot, because it's kind of an open question. What we do know is that when you take a psychedelic like psilocybin or LSD, it disrupts all of the functioning of your normal brain networks. And so you usually have a bunch of brain areas that are communicating when you're awake and when you're doing stuff, that when you take a psychedelic, the way that those networks are communicating within each other is wildly different. And that's what also causes changes in your mood, changes in your thinking, and changes in your sort of visual and other types of perceptual processes. So things can look different, sounds can sound different, and you know, we feel emotionally different.
And how do you classify a drug as being a psychedelic or not?
You know, the question is kind of out because some people will use that term in different ways, but usually the main idea is if it's got this sort of profound mind-altering or mood-altering effect. The actual word psychedelic was meant to sort of invoke these effects that it's mind manifesting. So whatever is in your mind, it sort of helps kind of come out and you know, be expressed in a way.
It's like a brain cleanse.
Almost like a way of uncovering content, things that are happening sort of beneath the surface.
I have a quick question. Just like when it comes to psychedelics, because there's synthetic ones, I believe, like LSD, and then there's like the more natural ones. Like, can you talk about the distinguishing those two, basically? Like, what differences people should be aware of, and if it matters whether it's synthetic or not?
You know, ultimately, it doesn't matter that much. If they're classic psychedelics, they work in the serotonin system. And, you know, there's some like psilocybin, which is found in 200 species of mushrooms, and DMT, which is found in ayahuasca, which comes from plants. And you know, those are naturally occurring psychedelics. Mescaline also, which is found in cactus, like San Pedro or peyote. But then LSD was one that was synthesized in a lab. And there's others that have been synthesized since by chemists like Sasha Shulgin. And you know, they have different ways that they work in the brain, and they have different types of effects. But the being natural or synthetically made doesn't necessarily make one safer than the other.
So in that case, like you're pretty positive. Like if you're saying they're working on new psychedelics. So like if we had this conversation 5-10 years, there might be a bunch of new drugs that we'd be talking about, right?
There almost certainly will be, because chemists are actively taking like the chemicals that we know about, like psilocybin, tweaking them, and then testing them out in animals, and then hopefully humans. And that's been happening for decades.
Shit. Okay.
Damn. It's like a new pair of Jordans coming out, right? It got a new drop every week.
Yeah, for sure. That's actually correct. Yeah.
So why does our Mother Earth make these psychoreactive psychedelic things in the first place?
You know, don't have a clear answer for that. But if you look at plants in general, they create lots of these chemicals. So coffee creates caffeine. It's a naturally occurring alkaloid. Tobacco makes nicotine, another alkaloid. Psilocybin mushrooms make psilocybin. And all of those work in our neurotransmitter systems to interact like with our serotonin system, like a lock and key sort of. And then they then create those really profound psychoactive effects. But in terms of what, you know, reason like a mushroom would have to have this type of chemical in the system, it's unclear if it uses it almost like as a natural neurotransmitter within the organism, or, you know, some people have hypothesized that pretty much it's a self-defense mechanism, right? So if an animal comes along and eats it, it gets all fucked up, and then they're like, I'm not going to eat that anymore. So they stop. So that's been hypothesized.
Yeah, I could see that. If I went to Trader Joe's and I bought me some tangerines and they started making me tripping on a Tuesday afternoon, I probably would not buy those tangerines from Trader Joe's anymore.
Unless you liked it, but yeah.
Correct. True. I think it's all about the expectation being set.
Right, exactly. And animals have, you know, a difficult time referencing what the experience is like. We don't know, we can't talk to them, but one of the ways we know these drugs aren't really addictive the way other drugs like cocaine are, is because if you give animals free access to a drug like cocaine, they'll keep taking it. But with these psychedelics, usually you give them access to it, they'll take it, and then they'll stop.
Yeah. So. Now, these different type of drugs that you mentioned have been part of cultures of different civilizations for years and years and years back. Could you speak a little bit on that and how they're used in different times of the world?
Yeah, so we know that there's a long history of use by humans of psilocybin containing mushrooms and other natural occurring psychedelics. And, you know, we know that by the archaeological record. So we go to cave paintings where they paint men with like little mushrooms coming all out of their bodies, or they actually have these mushroom stones from Guatemala, which are like 3,000 years old, which show that for whatever reason, you know, in these ancient cultures and in these indigenous cultures, these were considered sacred. They were an important part of their sort of spiritual life. And, you know, the Aztecs use the word Teonanacatl to talk about these mushrooms. And which is roughly translated as divine flesh or God's flesh. So they kind of have this longstanding relationship with these plants that have these psychoactive substances as part of their spiritual lives.
Mm. Now, let's get deep real quick. What can you tell me about MK Ultra?
MK Ultra is really interesting. So in the middle of the 20th century, you know, certain parts of the U.S. government started looking at weaponizing drugs like LSD because they were thinking this could be used as a mind control drug. And there's obviously, this was in the middle of the Cold War, so they're really worried about what the Soviets were doing and all this stuff. And, you know, I think I'm not an expert on it, but there's some pretty cool books out there like Acid Dreams that talk about the history of this stuff. And basically the idea was that if we could use psychedelics to brainwash people or to trick them into telling us their spy secrets, you know, then that would be a great way to use these drugs for, you know, espionage type purposes. Turns out they don't work that well for that purpose. And actually there's some pretty funny recordings if you look of, you know, early testing where they were giving soldiers LSD and instead of marching and following orders, they're like playing with flowers and climbing trees.
MK Ultra is like the wildest thing. So I'm so happy you asked about it. It's crazy. But also that's my understanding of like a lot of when LSD was first made, and I forget the name of the guy who made it, but they were sort of like, they were sending it to militaries, to like mental health institutions. They were just kind of like, we don't know what to do with this thing yet. We just think there's potential, right? Like that was kind of how it came onto the scene from my understanding.
That's right. There's a chemist named Dr. Albert Hofmann who's working in Switzerland in 1943. He made LSD, and then he realized it had these really potent effects. Most drugs, right, we measure in milligrams. This drug, LSD specifically, is so strong that you take micrograms, which is, you know, an order of magnitude smaller. And you take 100 micrograms of LSD, and you feel some pretty powerful mind-altering effects. And so at the time, they were just handing it out. Like you said, they were giving it to scientists and psychiatrists all over the world who were doing different types of testing with it. And that early wave of research did show in some of the early experiments that it could be useful for therapeutic purposes, specifically treating things like addictions. That was a big area of research, trying to treat like alcoholism, for instance.
How do you think these drugs have impacted creativity in artists over time?
You know, that was a huge part of the counterculture during the 1960s, was these psychedelic drugs and drug use. And if you just look at, for instance, the back catalog of the Beatles and their discography, there's sort of a before they used LSD and after they used LSD. And you can see there's a big shift in not only some of the aesthetics in their, you know, musical work, but also in things like the costumes and the artwork that they're putting out with the albums. So it changed, you know, the visuals, it changed the sound. And again, that kind of goes back to these, mind manifesting effects, like it can kind of change the way that we're perceiving things. And so that led to, you know, a lot of the sort of tie-dye and you know, hippie aesthetic that people are pretty familiar with, going back to listen to the music from the 60s.
Damn.
I mean, you know, Hendrix and, you know, Janis Joplin and the Doors and all of those kind of seminal rock and roll artists of the era were certainly dabbling heavily with psychedelics. But, you know, I think it's not untrue these days probably as well.
Could you maybe talk a little bit more about like that specific period and the musicians you mentioned, just because from my like very limited research on the subject, just know that like that was really when it seemed like the media's war on these drugs sort of started. I think it was also maybe right around when the drugs were really like popping out on the scene, but basically where like there was this movement and everything was happening in San Francisco and people started to really like demonize LSD, whereas previously, even medically speaking, people were kind of excited about the potential. Can you talk about that like shift?
Yeah, that's a great question, because in the 1950s, it was mostly like nerdy guys and, you know, and scientists and laboratories and intellectuals who were interested in this stuff. And they were studying it seriously and they weren't having a lot of problems. You know, they were still figuring out how it worked and what to do with it. But, you know, early research in the 50s with LSD actually led to and helped us discover serotonin and the neurotransmitter systems in our brain, which we didn't really know about before that. But then all of a sudden, people start to popularize it more in the, you know, outside the laboratory settings. And that really kind of came around during that hippie counterculture of the 1960s, just as, you know, rock and roll was emerging, kind of moving from, you know, the sort of early period, the more doo-wop and that kind of bubblegum pop stuff that even the Beatles were doing earlier on, and transforming into more dark, but also kind of more challenging types of music that was happening. And, you know, that was, so, you know, the Summer of Love was happening, Haight-Ashbury, that's San Francisco, you know, all the stuff that's popping up then and there, and leading, kind of culminating in Woodstock in 1969. And during all that period, you have all this other stuff happening that's super interesting, but it's such a echo of what we're seeing now, which is there is a lot of polarization between different political ideologies, kind of more conservative, old school ways of thinking, and then kind of these new school, you know, directions that were popping up. So there was the anti-war movement against Vietnam, you know, there was the civil rights movement, Black Panthers, women's liberation. So all these new ideas coming up. And just like today, we have, you know, again, Black Lives Matter, Me Too, you know, all this stuff happening where we're trying to sort of raise voices from marginalized communities. And, you know, I think that the status quo saw that as a huge threat. And as a result, Nixon administration in 1970 created the Controlled Substances Act, and they basically took cannabis and all these psychedelics, put them in what they call Schedule One, making them effectively illegal and very difficult to study or to get access to. And then also saying, great, now we can go crack down on all our political enemies, which were basically Black people and hippies who were anti-war and who were, you know, basically trying to just get equality. And so they went and started arresting people. And that really was the beginning of the war on drugs, which has, you know, been a huge problem, I think, socially ever since.
And now, so you said that chemists and researchers are doing studies on psychedelics now. How are they able to do that if these drugs are still in those Schedule One classes?
you do a shit ton of paperwork, basically. It's just a lot of getting licenses, special licenses from the DEA, special approvals from the FDA. And so there's a lot of infrastructure you need to have built in, like in my lab here where I work. Like, we have a pharmacy downstairs with a big safe, and the DEA, you know, came to visit to make sure that everything is secure. So you need to have a lot of government approvals to be able to do work like that. But, you know, a lot of this work is kind of moving in the direction of medical approval. And so ideally, if, you know, the studies that are happening now, for instance, show that psilocybin is an effective treatment for depression, then that would lead to some change in the scheduling status or legal status of psilocybin, so that then people will be able to go to special clinics to get it for treatment, similar to what you see with cannabis, you know, which has been moving that direction for years.
Yeah. Have you done psychedelics yourself?
So that's a great question. We don't always answer that one because it's got a little bit of a double-edged sword for us. On the one hand, you know, if you're saying that you haven't done psychedelics and you study psychedelics, then people think, you know, how does this guy know what he's talking about? And then on the other hand, if you say, I have done psychedelics and I study psychedelics, then people are going to say, you know, this guy's biased. He obviously has an agenda because of his personal experience. So as a result, usually we, you know, we'll kind of take the
fifth. Plead the fifth.
Yeah.
Five. Just had to ask.
Yeah, of course.
That's fair. I mean, I had to ask Golden the same thing. So there you go.
Yeah, and what was the answer? I didn't hear that. So,
oh yeah, I said I've done it a couple of times. Like, probably one of the most memorable, the impactful times was with my mom. We did it together for her first time, and we were on like the beach in San Francisco, and we just talked for hours, and it was like a really good bonding experience.
Yeah, and so that's great because you can kind of see, you know, you could have had the same conversation with your mom with or without the drug, but it facilitates different types of processes in terms of the way that we're feeling and the way we're communicating, maybe opens us up a little bit more. And so I think that's why we also can find them useful in a sort of therapeutic process as well.
Yeah.
I have just another question about, like, even your work specifically, Al, of what studies are basically still sort of being done. I feel like for so many years now, you know, you can pick up a newspaper or something, you'll see like, taking shrooms like helps with depression, or I feel like these things have been like floating out there for years and years, right? So what is still sort of being studied, and like what are the next steps of potentially further medicinizing? I don't know. I don't know what the word is, but essentially
medicalizing. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. So the main thing with psilocybin right now is looking at it as a treatment for depression. There's big studies that need to happen to get it medically approved for that, like, you know, 200-300 people. So there's been lots of smaller studies. But now those bigger studies are in the works, and if the results are good, that was going to kind of move into a medical approval phase. Same is true with MDMA for PTSD. So MDMA, also known as Molly or ecstasy, has been being studied for years as a treatment for post-traumatic stress disorder. And so far, the results are really remarkable. They seem to show a lot of good effects for people, you know, within a structured treatment. And so that's also moving towards that medical approval. But, you know, we're really just scratching the surface because there's all these other psychedelics like mescaline and ayahuasca and 5-MeO-DMT. So we're starting to study some of those other drugs, but we're also starting to expand our breadth of what we study with psilocybin even. So at our lab, we're doing studies in people with Alzheimer's disease, anorexia. You know, we're going to start a study of obsessive compulsive disorder. So we're really just trying to branch out and see what else we can do with these types of drugs as tools for, you know, therapeutic treatments. And of course, you know, one of the big areas that was of interest many years ago and still of interest today is in treating substance use disorders or addictions, because that's one area where we're still pretty stuck in terms of not having very effective treatments available.
Why is it that, like, potentially taking one drug could stop an addiction for another drug? Like, how is it that that works? Because I did see, like, in the beginning when they were experimenting with, again, like you said, alcoholism, this guy who was a severe alcoholic didn't drink for a year afterwards. It's like, what do you think is actually going on in the brain that causes that?
Well, yeah, there's a couple of stories there. One, you know, if you just go back to the beginning of Alcoholics Anonymous and Bill Wilson, who is a founder of AA, you know, he credited his quitting drinking to having a sort of spiritual type of experience. And so for him, that was like this sort of really powerful moment that then led him to change his behavior afterwards. And so our hypothesis on that front is that these drugs can induce those really powerful experiences. And so within a treatment framework, if people can have those, then it can help them change their behavior. You know, that's a psychological explanation. On a brain basis, you know, that disruption of our normal brain networks, the way that they're communicating, also seems to sort of disrupt the normal addictive patterns. It can almost be like a rut that our brain gets into, or like a record that's skipping. And then all of a sudden you come along with this big, you know, this drug that disrupts all of that. And then bam, you know, the record goes back onto its normal groove and can continue to play without that skipping. And so we think, you know, the brain changes that are happening are also potentially helpful for getting people out of their addictive patterns.
Got it. Okay. Golden, we probably have time for like 2-3 more questions if you have anything. Up to you.
I got a certified expert right here. I don't want to miss out on the opportunity to ask you questions.
You ask as many as you want.
Let's see. What do you think about psychedelics influence on Silicon Valley and the whole tech scene?
That's fascinating history as well, because you know, we were talking about the Haight-Ashbury and Woodstock and all that stuff. There was kind of like, just like with RAV, there is like a sort of East Coast, West Coast thing going on back in the day with researchers on the East Coast at Harvard and who were kind of square, but that included people like Timothy Leary. And then these researchers on the West Coast, well, maybe not researchers, but that included people in Palo Alto and Silicon Valley, Grateful Dead. And a lot of the people who became pioneers in the tech and computer industry. I actually went to graduate school in Palo Alto, so I was out there for 5 years, and you can really see there's this huge, obviously, you know, tech industry there. But the story is that, you know, the invention of the internet, a lot of the types of computer innovations that we now are so used to, really had their start with people using psychedelics and having these innovative ideas. And so people like Steve Jobs, you know, who was one of the founders of Apple, you know, credits some of his big ideas and his creative breakthroughs to having experiences with LSD.
Damn. Yeah. We were talking about that before. Yeah. See, I told you.
You were right. I was about to pull out Wikipedia on you. Yeah, I hadn't heard that. He mentioned like maybe we wouldn't have the iPhone if he hadn't taken LSD, you know. It's wild.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think for a lot of innovators, you know, these drugs have been pivotal for them to, you know, have new ideas or to kind of bolster their creativity in some way. So whether that be something tech related or something, you know, more on the artistic side of the fence. So when you're looking at artists and musicians across the board, there's been a big cultural impact.
What are your thoughts on microdosing?
Microdosing has not been well studied yet. There's only been like 4 or 5, you know, controlled studies, placebo controlled studies. Mm-hmm. The big problem with microdosing is that there's a ton of variance in how people do it. Some people might use it, you know, a certain amount or a certain substance or a certain number of times. And so that makes it hard to study. But when we bring people into the lab and study them and give them placebos too, so far the results haven't shown a lot of what you would consider good effects. It's mainly just, you know, noise. I mean, we haven't seen like what would be considered psychological benefits yet, but there's so much anecdotal data from people saying that they're getting benefits that my guess is if we study this better and more carefully, we could find places where this could help people, like maybe for people with ADHD or maybe for people with depression or anxiety, it could be useful. But yeah, the research right now is very limited, so we don't know very much.
Okay, cool. Hey, I appreciate your time, Al. Thank you very much.
Yeah, man, my pleasure. And I just want to say, I'm listening to your El Dorado, and awesome album and great work. So I'm a fan.
Thank you very much.
Thank you guys so much for doing this.
All right, yeah, you guys have a good one.
Peace, y'all.
You can see 24K Golden on tour this summer. Head to his website to find the tour dates near you. You can also read more about Al's work on the website for the Center for Psychedelic Consciousness Research. V1NO is produced by Ryan Killian Krause. I'm Matthias. We'll see you next time.